the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, this is Democracy Now! 100,000 to a quarter of a million. That's the U.S. death toll the White House is now predicting.
And I'm doing this because of my health and my fellow workers' health as well. It should be closed down, it should be cleaned properly, and we should be working in our environment. We can't even get gloves from the machine.
After Amazon warehouse worker Chris Smalls helped organize a strike to protest unsafe working conditions, he was fired. We'll get his response. And three workers at a large UPS facility near Boston have tested positive. Two dozen are quarantined. Details about the infections were only shared by the workers' union. We'll speak with a 20-year UPS worker and an organizer with Teamsters for a Democratic Union. Then today is April 1st. Millions across the country don't have the money to pay rent.
Asking them to reduce our rent by a minimum of 50% beginning April 1st, so this Wednesday, with the possibility up to 100% rent reduction or forgiveness for those tenants who have completely lost all forms of income and won't be able to pay.
Finally, we speak with a woman who says, I'm 9 months pregnant and I'm bringing my baby into a world I no longer understand.
We failed to factor in, you know, plans for a global pandemic threatening to shut down the healthcare system just a few weeks before my due date.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The White House Coronavirus Task Force projected Tuesday between 100,000 and 240,000 people will die of COVID-19 in the United States, but only if the strictest quarantine measures are kept in place. President Donald Trump, who this week extended social distancing guidelines through the end of April, said the worst is yet to come.
We're going to go through a very tough 2 weeks. And then hopefully, as the experts are predicting, as I think a lot of us are predicting after having studied it so hard, you're going to start seeing some real light at the end of the tunnel. But this is going to be a very painful, very, very painful 2 weeks.
President Trump said without efforts to mitigate the spread of the coronavirus, up to 2.2 million Americans could die of COVID-19. The grim assessment stood in stark contrast to Trump's repeated claims in recent weeks that the virus is under control and that it would miraculously go away by April. As of today, April 1st, the United States has the highest number of COVID-19 cases in the world, with over 188,000 people infected. Of course, the numbers are expected to be far higher because of the lack of access to tests, and over 4,000 dead. And the true rate of infection is not known. Here in New York City, the epicenter of the U.S. crisis, the death toll from COVID is nearly 1,100 and continuing to climb. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is dispatching more than 250 ambulances, 85 refrigerated trucks to New York to serve as temporary morgues. The Intercept reports prisoners at Rikers Island Jail are being offered $6 an hour and personal protective equipment if they agree to dig mass graves at a public cemetery on Hart Island. The coronavirus continues to spread rapidly at Rikers, where at least 167 prisoners and 137 staff members have tested positive. In Central Park, an emergency field hospital began operations Tuesday, treating spillover patients from nearby Mount Sinai Hospital. The effort is led by the Christian fundamentalist group Samaritan's Purse, whose leader Franklin Graham is virulently Islamophobic, anti-choice, anti-LGBTQ preacher, and has kept his university open. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio has promised to send aides to monitor the group to prevent discrimination against patients. Nationwide, the United States has confirmed over 188,000 cases of COVID-19 and over 4,000 deaths. California hospitalizations have doubled over the past 4 days, with intensive care cases tripling in that time. California health officials predict the state's peak of COVID-19 cases will be lower than New York's because stringent social distancing policies were adopted sooner. In Las Vegas, 500 unhoused people were displaced from a Catholic Charities homeless shelter after a resident tested positive for COVID-19. City and county officials have since set up an open-air encampment, painting lines on the pavement of the Cashman Center parking lot to keep unhoused people 6 feet apart. Meanwhile, thousands of Las Vegas hotel rooms remain empty during the lockdown. In Chicago, a COVID-19 unit nurse said she resigned Monday after hospital administrators barred her from wearing an N95 protective mask she brought with her to work. The nurse, Amaris Vera, posted this video on social media.
I had my own N95 mask. I told my manager I understand we're short on supplies, but let me protect myself. Let me feel safe. I have family that I have to come home to, and the way things are looking, this isn't going to get any better. America is not prepared, and nurses are not being protected.
In Austin, Texas, 28 young adults tested positive after a spring break trip to southern Baja California and Mexico, with dozens more under public health investigation. Meanwhile, Russia has promised to deliver a plane load of personal protective equipment and other medical supplies after President Trump placed a call to Vladimir Putin on Monday. Federal Reserve economists are warning the coronavirus pandemic could push the U.S. unemployment rate above 32% by the end of June, higher than the peak jobless rate of 25% during the Great Depression. The news comes as thousands of tenants around the country are calling for immediate rent cancellation. Later in the broadcast, we'll hear from an organizer of today's April 1st rent strike, and we'll hear from UPS drivers and Amazon workers organizing for safer working conditions amidst the pandemic. The Congressional Hispanic Caucus has joined thousands of medical professionals and immigrant rights groups in demanding Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that's ICE, release all prisoners from immigration jails. At least four asylum seekers and five ICE agents have tested positive for COVID-19, raising fears for the more than 37,000 immigrants jailed in crowded facilities across the United States. In Louisiana, The Intercept reports women jailed at the privately owned South Louisiana ICE Processing Center are terrified they've been exposed to a person ill with coronavirus. The women flashed handmade signs to a video visitation camera describing an Ecuadorian woman who worked in the kitchen who was given oxygen and carried away on a gurney after presenting symptoms consistent with COVID-19. Meanwhile, more than 80 immigrant prisoners at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, Washington, continue their hunger strike to protest conditions inside the privately owned jail, demanding their immediate release, reunification with their families, and temporary humanitarian visas. On Tuesday, supporters surrounded the immigration jail in a caravan of cars, honking their horns in support of the hunger strikers. BuzzFeed reports California plans to release 3,500 nonviolent prisoners on parole in the next 60 days to try to reduce prison overcrowding. Although California's total prison population is about 122,000, this would be still the largest mass release of U.S. prisoners since the pandemic began. On Guam, the captain of the USS Theodore Roosevelt pleaded with U.S. Navy officials to allow thousands of sailors to disembark to prevent the spread of the coronavirus aboard the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, where more than 100 U.S. sailors have tested positive. Captain Brett Crozer warned in a letter to the Navy's Pacific Fleet, quote, "We are not at war. Sailors do not need to die. If we do not act now, we are failing to properly take care of our most trusted asset, our sailors," he said. CNN reports sailors aboard a second U.S. aircraft carrier, the USS Ronald Reagan, have also tested positive. Meanwhile, in Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has warned the operators of a pair of stricken cruise ships not to seek refuge in his state, telling Fox News he doesn't want to, quote, see people dumped in southern Florida right now. Four people have died on board one of the cruise ships. Dozens more have reported flu-like symptoms. This comes as Florida Governor DeSantis has defied calls to order all residents to remain at home, even though Florida is home to one of the nation's largest populations of people 65 and older. In Italy, cities nationwide observed a minute of silence at noon Tuesday to remember victims of the coronavirus pandemic. Italy has reported the world's highest death toll from the disease, with 837 deaths in the last 24 hours alone, bringing the total to over 12,000. With Italy's hospitals completely overwhelmed, Germany has continued to receive coronavirus patients. Spain has reported its highest daily coronavirus toll, with 849 new deaths over the last 24 hours. One nurse in Madrid, posting on social media, said the official number of confirmed COVID-19 cases, now over 100,000, is far lower than the true toll.
Pues que estamos totalmente desbordados.
We are completely overflowed. Health workers are exhausted, physically and emotionally, because this is awful. This is an inferno. The numbers that I'm seeing on television are false. Why are they false? Because they are not testing people.
In Greece, an asylum seeker tested positive for COVID-19 after a stay in a crowded refugee camp north of Athens that's home to 2,500 people. In Russia, a doctor who gave President Vladimir Putin a tour of Moscow's coronavirus hospital unit last week has himself tested positive. Putin says he'll begin holding government meetings by video conference. In Brazil, authorities have set up field hospitals for COVID-19 patients in some of the world's most storied soccer stadiums. Residents of high-rise apartment buildings in cities like Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro continue to hold nightly protests from their windows and balconies, banging pots and pans and calling for the resignation of the far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, who has repeatedly dismissed COVID-19 as a little flu and urged Brazilians to get back to work. In Nigeria, Africa's largest city, Lagos, home to 21 million people, fell quiet Tuesday as a stay-at-home order went into effect. Many residents say they're more worried about starving than they are of contracting COVID-19.
So it's not easy at all. Even to buy 1 week food, it's not, it's talk less of 2 weeks. And we have three kids. And we still have our grandma that is living with us. So it's not easy at all because the money to use to buy it, even we don't have it now.
In Uganda, police arrested at least three Catholic priests after they celebrated Mass Sunday in violation of a ban on religious gatherings during the pandemic. On the outskirts of the capital, Kampala, police raided a shelter for homeless LGBTQ youths, arresting 20 people for allegedly violating quarantine. Those arrested were reportedly beaten and forced to take a walk of shame through the village. Uganda LGBTQ campaigners say they were targeted because of their sexual orientation. Authorities in Indonesia's second-largest city, Surabaya, have deployed drones to spray clouds of disinfectant in residential neighborhoods, even though health officials warn the chemicals are likely to cause irritation and respiratory problems. In media news, Vanity Fair reports that executives at Fox News are worried they could face lawsuits from viewers over the far-right cable network's misleading coverage of the coronavirus pandemic. For weeks, as the virus spread, Fox News hosts portrayed the pandemic as a hoax designed to damage President Trump's re-election prospects. Meanwhile, CNN's primetime host Chris Cuomo has tested positive for COVID-19. On Tuesday, Cuomo broadcast from his home basement, where he says he'll remain in isolation until he recovers. His brother, the New York governor, Andrew Cuomo, wishes him well. Texas will be allowed to enforce its abortion ban during the coronavirus outbreak after an appeals court judge overturned the ruling of a federal judge who'd put a temporary hold on the abortion ban just hours before. Texas's abortion ban was put in place last week as part of the state's plan to stem the spread of the coronavirus, claiming abortions are, quote, non-essential procedures. In environmental news, the Trump administration's finalized its rollback of Obama-era fuel efficiency standards for new U.S. vehicles in a massive blow against efforts to mitigate the worst effects of the climate crisis. The rollbacks will allow U.S. vehicles to emit some 1 billion more tons of carbon dioxide than previously allowed, equivalent to at least a fifth of annual U.S. emissions. And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Tuesday proposed a gradual lifting of U.S. economic sanctions on Venezuela if opposition leaders and some members of President Nicolas Maduro's political party form an interim government.
Thinking it would put the elected members of the National Assembly representing both sides, would create an acceptable Council of State to serve as the transitional government until presidential and National Assembly elections could be held, we hope within 6 to 12 months.
The proposal would require both Venezuelan President Maduro and the Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido to step aside. A similar strategy was used in 1989 ahead of the U.S. invasion of Panama. Venezuela's foreign ministry called the proposal, quote, an effort to win geopolitical advantage in the midst of a frightening global pandemic, unquote. The move comes less than a week after the Trump administration indicted Maduro on charges of narco-terrorism and international cocaine trafficking. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the epicenter of the pandemic here in the United States, right here in New York City, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez from his home in New Brunswick, New Jersey, the state with the second most documented infections in the United States. Juan, it's so good to see you, although I wish you were right here next to me in these times of the pandemic. It's so critical that we stay apart to protect ourselves, our community, and the community at large.
Yes, Amy, good day to you, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, the White House is now estimating that between 100,000 and a quarter of a million people could die from the coronavirus pandemic. Some of those most concerned about exposure to the highly infectious virus are workers on the front lines of, well, grocery stores and delivery services. This is in addition to all the attention to the doctors and nurses and the staffs of hospitals across the country. On Monday, workers who fulfill orders for Instacart staged a protest to demand better working protections and hazard pay. Also Monday, Amazon warehouse workers in Staten Island walked off the job. Amazon fired one of them in response, and we'll get his response later in the broadcast. Amazon says they fired him because he wasn't doing social distancing. He tells a different story. On Tuesday, Whole Foods workers organized a national sick-out protest demanding double normal wages for workers as hazard pay for working on the front lines during a pandemic. This comes as three workers at a large U.S. UPS facility near Boston have tested positive, and two dozen more have been quarantined. For more, we're joined from his home in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, by Richard Hooker, Secretary Treasurer of the Philadelphia Teamsters Local 623, the first African-American to ever lead the 101-year-old union after being elected Secretary Treasurer in November. Richard Hooker has worked at UPS for 20 years. We welcome you, Richard, to Democracy Now! Can you describe what was happening where you worked? What kind of access do you have to protective gear, to washing your hands? Describe the scenario.
Well, in the beginning of it all, there was no access to being clean, no soap in the bathrooms. Some bathrooms had no running water, no hot water.
Where do you work?
At the airport facility in Philadelphia.
Keep going and describing what was happening there.
So what was happening was, like I said, the bathrooms were not up, was not clean, no running water, dirt everywhere. The facilities were a mess, trash everywhere, dirt everywhere. We took pictures. We sent them to the company, let them know, hey, this is the issues that we're having here, and we need some help. And all the response that we would get was that the government deemed UPS essential, and we were to keep working. So we kept going. We filed grievances. Under our contract, you know, sanitation and safety are a big issue. So we filed grievances against the company with that. Still, no response, no communication. We sent letters to our governor here in Pennsylvania to get some help. Since we are deemed essential, we need to make sure that our people are protected during this pandemic. That wasn't happening. So that's why we sent letters to the governor. Still no response from the company. Same old, business as usual. And so we did a interview on a national news network. It got a little traction, but still the company refused to communicate with what they were doing. And The members were very, very upset, anxious, concerned, because if we are so essential, then we need to make sure that our people are protected and not feel like we're disposable. So we did another national news broadcast, and we laid it all out in the line. We told them, hey, this is what was going on. The bathrooms, pictures, video of the water not even being able to be turned on, trash everywhere, the facilities not being cleaned. We kept doing that. We talked about it on live TV everywhere. Then all of a sudden now the company wanted to sit down and talk and come up with some ideas and plans. So this past Monday, we had a sit down meeting with the president of our district, Mrs. Kim, and she gave us her commitment and the company's commitment that they would communicate with us everything they were doing. Cleaning the bathrooms would be a priority, making sure there was going to be social distancing, making sure the water was run, making sure there was multiple cleaning crews coming in to clean the facilities constantly. Unfortunately, even though there's been some progress, it's not enough. There's still no social distancing. Some of our members still not getting the supplies that they need. The communication has gotten better. So I'll be relaying some more information to the powers that be to keep this thing going. But again, there's still a big disconnect between what they're saying and then what's really going on in the operation. And our members are at risk. We just
Richard Hooker, I wanted to ask you, given the fact that so many millions of Americans are being forced to stay home, I would assume that there has been a huge increase in the work that UPS and other delivery companies have. What did you notice any change from the time that most Americans were told to stay in place and stay at home in how the company dealt with the workers before and after the pandemic exploded?
There has been an increase in the residential deliveries, not so much in the business, because a lot of businesses, as you guys know, are closed. But when people are sitting at home, they do a lot more ordering. So the residential part has really skyrocketed. Now, there hasn't been a big difference on what the company has done before this pandemic or during it. It's still business as usual. It's not a lot of let's try to get our members, the supplies they need. There's not been a concern on their part. Even though I know they come out and they say it and they try to downplay what's really going on, from our standpoint, it hasn't been enough. And to our members, it's definitely not enough, because like you guys mentioned, there's been 3 confirmed cases up in Boston, but we have 2 confirmed cases here in Philadelphia, one in Oregon Avenue building and one in the PHL building. And again, we had to fight to get that information. Before, they weren't telling us anything. And so we had to keep fighting and fighting and fighting and pushing and pushing and pushing just to get the information so we can let our members know what's going on. So it's still been the same. They're going to keep doing what they're doing. It seems, and it always has been, profit over people. Profit over people. But us as a union, we're not profit-based. We're membership-based. We care about our members. And that's what this is all about, protecting our members.
Richard Hooker, we want to thank you so much for being with us. We're going to continue this discussion on the other side of the break as well with David Levin. Richard Hooker is Secretary Treasurer of the Philadelphia Teamsters Local 623, has worked at UPS for 20 years. When we come back, David Levin, lead organizer with Teamsters for a Democratic Union and coordinator of the UPS Teamsters United campaign. Stay with us and stay safe, Richard. Thank you. Alone Together by jazz trumpeter and composer Wallace Roney, who died March 31st of COVID-19. He was 59 years old. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in New York. Juan Gonzalez is in New Jersey. And as we've reported, at least three workers at the large UPS facility near Boston have tested positive. Two dozen more have been quarantined. Details about the infections were shared by the workers' union. Teamsters Local 25 union president Sean O'Brien said in a statement, UPS was, quote, refusing to provide critical information to its workers regarding positive and presumptive positive COVID-19 cases in the facility. For more, we continue to look at organizing efforts by workers on the front lines. We're joined from his home in Philadelphia by David Levine, lead organizer with Teamsters for a Democratic Union, coordinator of the UPS Teamsters United campaign. David, we just have a few minutes, and we'd like you to link what's going on with UPS and the union negotiations with United Postal Service, with UPS, with what's going on at Amazon and Instacart, the people who are protesting outside demanding that they have to have a safe workplace, too.
Well, thanks for having me so much. You know, Amazon workers are raising the exact same issues that Richard was just talking about and that UPS workers across the country are raising: a lack of personal protective equipment, unsanitary conditions, not being informed when a coworker tests positive, the workplace not being sanitized properly. These are after someone tests positive. These are all CDC and OSHA guidelines. They're not being followed, and we need to hold these corporations accountable. You know, UPS and Amazon are competitors, but UPS workers and Amazon workers are not. We share the same concerns. We have the same corporations that we have to hold accountable. So one of the things that we did as Teamsters for a Democratic Union and our UPS Teamsters United campaign, last night we launched a national petition specifically reaching out to UPS Teamsters around the country to call for the reinstatement of Chris Smalls, who I guess you have coming up on the show later, who was fired for organizing a protest around these issues at Amazon. We're all in this together. We're demanding for these health and safety issues to be addressed both at UPS and at Amazon and for all workers.
David, very quickly, what do you say? I mean, what do you say to Amazon wrote to us last night and said he wasn't fired for organizing, but for not maintaining social distance and not going home and quarantining since he was near someone who tested positive?
Yeah, well, the next time that a corporation admits that someone was fired for organizing will be the next time that Democracy Now! Gets a $1 million donation from Amazon. It's not going to happen. Everyone who knows what happened. The difference in the situation is that if you're a union worker, you have more protections to be organizing and taking action. A lot of Teamsters are doing that. When their unions aren't, when their local union isn't helping, Teamsters for a Democratic Union and UPS TeamstersUnited.org, we're here. People can reach out to be a resource. And we need to be, this is a time when union workers, Teamsters, and Amazon workers need to be making connections, because over the long haul, not just in this crisis, we need to be working together to hold these corporations accountable.
And David Levin, I wanted to ask you this about over the long haul, because really this pandemic is really creating a major shift in the way that goods are distributed in our society, as increasingly people are being forced to go online and therefore to have packages delivered by companies like UPS and Amazon and others. I'm wondering, do you sense that the labor movement is prepared, organized labor is prepared for what is essentially a radical shift that, for instance, Macy's just announced they're laying off or furloughing 100,000 workers, that the brick and mortar stores are really at an enormous disadvantage right now. And these delivery companies now are going to have a much greater share of the market in America. I'm wondering how you feel that if the labor movement is prepared for this shift in distribution of goods in the society.
Well, one thing I want to say about UPS, this is a company that makes $6 billion a year. They can track a package at any moment, anywhere around the globe. They track their workers' movements everywhere they are at all times, and they can't seem to track down or won't track down personal protective equipment, masks, gloves, hand sanitizers that workers need. That's why people are organizing to demand that. The Teamsters Union is a logistics workers union. We're a transportation union. We're a package union. We're a grocery and food delivery union. We're the logical hub to be organizing and uniting and bringing workers together. We're doing that at the grassroots level at Teamsters for a Democratic Union. You see some aggressive local union leaders pushing for that. And we need a transformation, we believe, in the Teamsters Union, in the top leadership, which has largely been missing in action through this crisis, if we're going to meet the kinds of challenges that you were just laying out.
David Levine, we want to thank you so much for being with us, lead organizer with Teamsters for a Democratic Union and the coordinator of the UPS Teamsters United campaign. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with co-host Juan Gonzalez speaking to us from his home in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And now we're going to talk about a different kind of delivery. I'm 9 months pregnant, and I'm bringing my baby into a world I no longer understand. I have to remain hopeful anyway, writes journalist Amy Littlefield in a new piece for Insider. Her baby is due Sunday. Amy Littlefield recently joined us from her home in Boston, Massachusetts, and I spoke to her before Governor Andrew Cuomo here in New York released an executive order Saturday saying hospitals could not force pregnant people to give birth without a chosen support person, the order coming in response to a move by both New York Presbyterian and the Mount Sinai hospital systems to bar partners from labor and delivery rooms, causing widespread outrage, even in this pandemic. A petition opposing the ban gathered over 600,000 signatures. So this was the context in which we spoke. And Amy Littlefield is a part of the Democracy Now! Family, a former Democracy Now! Producer. Again, her baby is due on Sunday. I asked her about the reality she's confronting now at the end of her pregnancy.
First of all, giving birth in the United States, let's just say it can be a terrifying experience in the best of times. I mean, we have the highest maternal mortality rate among wealthy nations. And we, you know, even with insurance, people often on average end up paying more than $4,500 out of pocket for their delivery. These were predictable failures that my partner and I had thought about before we decided to have our first child. And because I'm a journalist who reports on reproductive health care, I had thought a lot about these issues. But of course, we failed to factor in, you know, plans for a global pandemic threatening to shut down the healthcare system just a few weeks before my due date.
About all your plans, take us through you planned this so carefully, and all your hopes, your dreams, your birth plan, what you were going to do, and how you've been forced to cope at this point.
I mean, we had, you know, I had controlled my anxiety around the, you know, the unpredictability that's built into birth by planning every single aspect of it that I could. We were touring hospitals before I was even pregnant. I was interrogating the tour guides about whether they had nitrous oxide machines and how many birth tubs did they have. And the people who were actually pregnant were just like, where do I park my car? And so we, you know, read all the books. We hired a doula because we know that the evidence shows having a doula really increases people's you know, decreases chances of having interventions like C-sections and creates a more positive experience for people giving birth. So we were so
And explain what a doula is, Amy.
A doula is somebody who is an emotional support person who's an expert in things like helping you find comfortable positions, in massage, in, you know, advocating for people among healthcare providers, helping people make informed decisions. They're really there to provide the emotional support as well as the expertise, you know, during labor. And there's just a huge body of evidence showing that they, you know, increase positive outcomes and decrease the need for birth interventions. And so we felt that was a crucial part of our care, and we were privileged to be able to afford that. As little as 2 weeks ago, our midwife was still assuring us that our doula could be with us during our birth. And a few days later, that had changed. And like so many people in my situation around the country right now, we were told that our doula couldn't be with us. The hospital was restricting visitors to only one, which meant only my partner would be there. My family wouldn't be able to visit. Now, seeing what's happening with New York Presbyterian, of course, we're afraid that my partner might not even be allowed into the delivery room, and we're having to think about what that could look like.
Even before talking about how you stayed fit and healthy going to yoga, how did those yoga classes change with pregnant people?
Well, I mean, I think like so many people, there's you know, so many of us over the last few weeks, things are changing so quickly, and there's a moment when you realize the world is different. And for me, that came just under 2 weeks ago, I guess, when I went to my regular prenatal yoga class that I relied on to, you know, deal with those, you know, crazy aches and pains that can come with pregnancy. And usually it's packed, and I walked in and there was one other person there, and then one other person joined us. And as trivial as it might seem, that was sort of the moment that I knew that the world was changing, and that something that had felt like sort of this distant threat that was now about to disrupt our lives in a big way. And pretty soon after that, my partner and I made the decision to stop leaving the house and except to walk our dog, because we really didn't want either of us to get sick before delivery. Mm-hmm.
But you did have some friends in about a week ago.
We did. We had not the Friday the 13th, so not this most recent Friday, but the one before. We had friends over to bring us some groceries, and you know, I let them into the house. I felt so buoyed by their visit and happy to see them. We kept several feet away, and several hours later, one of the friends texted me to say they were running a fever and body aches, and we just panicked. I mean, rubbed down everything we thought they had touched with bleach and jumped in the shower, dragged our dog in with us, washed her from head to toe, which she was pretty baffled by. And I just remember standing there thinking, please give me more time. I'm not ready to give birth in this moment. I don't even understand what's happening.
And you then talk about losing your doula because she won't be able to be in the delivery room. And now the question of whether your partner will be able to join you. You're about a week or two behind New York. In New York, the New York Presbyterian has apparently made this decision, announcing on Sunday it would no longer allow visitors for patients giving birth, including allowing partners to be present during childbirth, even though the World Health Organization has said that all pregnant people, including those with confirmed or suspected COVID-19 infections, should have the right to have a chosen companion present during labor. So what does this bring up for you? What are you thinking now in these last weeks before you give birth? Or it could be hours, of course, because you're at 38.
could happen right now. I mean, it's the idea of giving birth without my partner there to comfort me, to, you know, advocate for me, to share in what should be the happiest moment of our lives is kind of unfathomable to me. And my heart breaks for the people who are going through that right now at New York Presbyterian, who are having to give birth without a partner, any family member, any support person there with them, just totally alone. I mean, what can be a terrifying experience if it feels like it's out of your control. It has prompted us to think about switching to a home birth at the last minute, which legions of people are doing right now. I mean, apparently the home birth midwives are just getting inundated with requests, last minute requests from people like me who are 2 weeks away from their due date and afraid to contemplate going into a hospital, afraid that all their autonomy will be taken away or that the hospitals will just be so inundated that, you know, it won't be safe to give birth there. And, you know, I spoke with my doula yesterday about the possibility of a home birth. And she said, look, this is really something that you shouldn't do out of fear because you'll open the door to trauma. You should do it out of confidence that it's something that you want and that's the right decision for you. And I just, when I got off the phone with her, I just burst into tears because how can any of us who are facing this decision thinking about making it out of anything but fear in this moment? I mean, the fear of being separated from our partners in that moment is absolutely what's driving this. And so,
and what does it mean, a home? What would that involve? I mean, it's a whole different trajectory, of course.
Right.
And you are doing this, and people plan for this for a long time. You're doing this
exactly
in a few days, if you were to do it.
Right, right. I mean, first of all, it costs thousands and thousands of dollars. It's just not an option for many people because it's generally not covered by insurance. So that's not something we had planned or budgeted for. Secondly, you know, you have to think about turning your home into an impromptu delivery room. You have to think about meeting a care provider that you've never met before that you would have to build trust with very quickly. And I don't think that with so little time to plan it, it's actually, I don't know whether it's less scary or more scary to do that than to think about going into a hospital, which is a complete unknown at this point. We just don't know what the medical system in Boston will look like 2 weeks from now.
You talk about in your piece how your grandmother is in failing health, but was so excited at 100 years old to be able to hold her little grandchild.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what's been keeping her going. She's told me that. So her nursing home is basically shut down to visitors, which is right. And they should do that. And I would not contemplate visiting her right now. But I don't know how long it will be and whether she has that much time, you know, to be able to meet her great-grandchildren. And so many people I know are in my position. And facing these very same choices, painful choices.
You write in your piece about your parents and since everything was so perfectly planned, your thoughts about them coming into the hospital and what you would reveal to them.
Yes, we've been keeping the name and the baby's presumed sex secret the whole pregnancy. We've worked very hard to guard that. And I had just really looked forward to that moment in the hospital room when they would get to meet their grandchild and when we would reveal that information to them. And it's not going to happen that way. I don't know when it will happen.
So they can't come into the hospital, you know. You don't know if your partner will be able to join you.
Exactly.
But then afterwards, given all of the issues of social distance.
And it's heartbreaking. I'm in, you know, online communities, and I've heard from so many other people who are pregnant about the very painful decision making of, you know, pushing family away for safety in a moment where you expected to hold them close and to be with them and to just treasure, you know, the moments you never get back, the first moments of a child's life. It's really tough. And we're trying not to, we haven't made any final decisions about that yet because everything is changing day to day and we just don't know what the world will look like in a few weeks.
Well, Amy, as you always do during the most difficult circumstances, you always manage to find rays of hope. And I'm wondering what is sustaining you right now and what you're seeing outside and inside, since you are self-isolating. What is giving you the most hope right now?
I mean, it takes a tremendous amount of energy to give birth, right? Or so I've been told, and I'm trying to summon that energy and not sink into despair, which is difficult because, you know, how do you contemplate the fact that we are facing a situation where as many as 1.7 million people could die in this country, and it could have many of those deaths could have been prevented if our government had acted fast enough. How do you contemplate what's about to happen in the prisons and the immigrant detention centers and among the homeless population as this virus spreads? How do you, I mean, for me, it's how do I think about having to explain this to a child? And I think it's very easy to sink into despair and feel like the world is a terrifying place. And what's been pulling me back from that is just seeing all of these beautiful examples of mutual support.
That's Amy Littlefield, independent journalist, former Democracy Now! Producer, now documenting her own journey giving birth. We'll link to her article, "I'm 9 months pregnant. I'm bringing my baby into a world I no longer understand. I have to remain hopeful anyway." Shortly after Amy spoke to us, she got a call from her health provider saying her partner could not attend her prenatal visit at 38 weeks in the midst of the pandemic. He joined the appointment by phone. And this news today, her little sister is in the hospital in the very beginning of labor. Their parents about to have their first two grandchildren, though they won't be able to go to the hospital for each to meet them. When we come back, well, it's April 1st. Tenants are calling for rent to be canceled. Stay with us. In Black by Bob Andy and Marcia Griffiths. Jamaican singer and songwriter Bob Andy died of cancer last week at the age of 75. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in New York. Juan Gonzalez is in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Today is April 1st. Millions across the country do not have money to pay rent in the midst of this pandemic. But despite eviction moratoriums and relief on mortgage payments in hard-hit states like California, Washington, and New York, no rent freeze has been ordered. In response, tenants around the country are calling for immediate rent cancellation. Some are planning to rent strike. This is Crystal Stella Bursaro, a tenant in Brooklyn, speaking to PIX News.
Asking them to reduce our rent by a minimum of 50% beginning April 1st, so this Wednesday, with the possibility up to 100% rent reduction or forgiveness for those tenants who have completely lost all forms of income and won't be able to pay. We're standing in solidarity with those who can't, because we know that if three people in a building of 36 can't pay rent, those people will be taken to court and be evicted. But if we stand in solidarity with them, the chances of that happening are reduced.
That's Crystal Stella Bursaro, a tenant in Brooklyn, speaking to PIX News. According to one estimate, 40% of renters in New York City may not be able to make rent this month. And while a record 3 million people in the U.S. applied for unemployment last week, many workers who lost their livelihood still have not even been able to file for unemployment. Nearly 8 million people called the New York State Labor Department hotline last week, compared to an average 50,000 weekly calls. For more, we're joined by Sia Weaver, campaign coordinator for Housing Justice for All, which is organizing to cancel rent during the coronavirus pandemic. She's here in New York, as Juan Gonzalez is also in New Jersey. Sia, talk about what you are calling for on this first day of the month. Yes, no one is talking about April Fools in the midst of this pandemic, but clearly No one is canceling rent right now at a mass level.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. It's April 1st, and millions of New Yorkers are going to be unable to pay the rent today. While the eviction moratorium is a step in the right direction, it does nothing to prepare for when we emerge from this crisis. And so we are calling for full universal cancellation of all rent that has accrued during this crisis. So that means you can't pay. If you can't pay now, you don't have to pay, and you won't be taken to court for this rent later either.
And how do you respond to folks like Governor Cuomo, who has said he's all for a mortgage and rent moratorium, but not for cancellations per se?
Yeah, so Cuomo has actually not called for a rent moratorium. He's called for a mortgage moratorium for property owners. And, you know, I think that Governor Cuomo is simply just ignoring the fact that more than half of the state rents their homes. He has repeatedly said that the closure of housing courts, the eviction moratorium, is taking care of the rent issue. I think that he's got to be kidding himself if he thinks that that's true. I know he can't truly think that that's accurate. All that is just the very definition of kicking the can down the road.
I want to turn to Governor Cuomo speaking about the eviction moratorium at his press conference Tuesday. He's then asked about what renters should do when that moratorium ends.
You cannot be evicted for non-payment of rent, residential nor commercial, for 3 months. Again, we pick these intervals, and you can say they're somewhat random, but, you know, when is it going to end? Nobody knows. Pick an interval. So we said 3 months. You can't be evicted, residential or commercial, for non-payment of rent for 90 days. On that basis, my daughters have stopped paying me rent. I'm not even sure that their finances have dropped significantly, but I think they're just taking advantage of the non-eviction order that I myself posted. And I resent it.
Governor, what do you
I
say
love when they lie to me.
Renters should do once your 90-day moratorium on evictions ends, and they likely owe, you know, several months of rent? You know, unemployment is obviously
increasing. We'll deal with that when we get to it.
So that's Governor Cuomo's daily news conference from yesterday. Sia Weaver, if you could respond to what he said. And Governor Cuomo, who's now being talked about in all sorts of circles as a possible presidential candidate, a brokered convention, et cetera, what his history has been on housing here in New York?
Cuomo has a long history of standing with the real estate industry and not standing with the tenants. He's got a long history of standing with real estate over standing with public housing. He has worked in housing his whole career, and the entire time he has been on the side of the real estate industry. So it's not surprising to hear that he's not really taking seriously the rights of renters during this time and the fear that renters may feel about being unable to pay the rent on April 1st, on May 1st, on June 1st, and not really having a plan to move forward. It's unsurprising, but it is terrifying, and we need the governor to take urgent action here to take the rental crisis more seriously.
Sia, do you have any sense whether across the country the movement is spreading of people saying they just won't pay rent to their landlords?
Absolutely. There are more people who are waking up to the housing crisis today than ever before, and that's the thing that is giving me hope and making me feel like we're going to win this thing. The housing justice movement has been saying for a long time that everyone is just one major life event away from an eviction. We say that a lot. We say, you know, if your mother gets sick, or if you lose a job, or if you have a medical emergency yourself, that you may be just, you know, one paycheck away from an eviction. What's happening right now is that is happening to hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people all at once in our society. And so all of those people are turning to the housing justice movement and saying, wow, I was living that precariously. And sort of a moment, it's a moment where everybody is realizing just how the housing market is not working for renters and trying coming together to take political action.
And can I get your comment to Mayor de Blasio calling for a rent freeze for the 2.3 million tenants and nearly a million rent stabilized units across New York? The city saying the work with the state to suspend rent guidelines board process for the upcoming year. De Blasio is saying we're in the midst of a crisis only comparable to the Great Depression. The people of our city are struggling, and a rent freeze is a lifeline so many will need this year to stay above water. Sia.
Yeah, so I think, you know, you said it yourself. The buck stops with the governor, unfortunately, and it's great that de Blasio is taking this step, but we need Cuomo to take action. That's just the scenario that we're in right now. And then I think it's incredibly important to not forget the millions of other renters who are not rent stabilized, who are living precariously, without the right to a renewal lease in unregulated apartments, who have also lost income, who also need immediate relief now.
Well, Sia Weaver, we want to thank you so much for being with us, campaign coordinator for Housing Justice for All, organizing to cancel rent during the pandemic. And as we wrap up the show, Juan, this latest news that has just come out of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus joining with many others, 3,000 medical professionals, as well as many immigration rights groups, to for ICE to immediately release all 37,000 detainees in ICE custody. Juan.
Well, Amy, it's clear that given the huge number of people in detention, in immigration detention, overwhelmingly most of them have not been they've not been convicted of any crime. They're being detained while their status is adjudicated, and it seems positively mind-boggling that the federal government doesn't realize, especially in the crowded conditions that many of the detainees are in, that it would be the proper humanitarian policy to release them now to prevent the spread of COVID-19, and their status can be adjudicated after this crisis is over.
Well, we have to come to the end of the show. We tried to reach Chris Smalls, who organized the Amazon protest and was fired. Amazon said because he wasn't keeping social distancing rules or quarantining. And Chris Smalls alleges because he organized the protest at Amazon to keep workers safe. But we will certainly continue to follow this issue. And a little correction earlier in the headlines. I talked about Franklin Graham, the president of the Christian Relief Organization Samaritan's Purse, who's helped to organize a hospital outside of Mount Sinai here in New York in the middle of Central Park. I mentioned he was university president. He isn't. That's Jerry Falwell, who kept Liberty University open despite the concern of many staff, teachers, and students. That does it for our show. By the way, whether or not we have access to medical masks, using a scarf is a great idea when you go outside. We must all protect ourselves to protect the community. All safety to everyone. Juan, thanks so much for joining us. Democracy Now! Produced by a remarkable team. Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Dennis Moynihan, Trina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriana Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Be safe, all.